You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 9th of August, 2013, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Guy Delaunay, and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, today's agenda setter is James Schneider, the editor of Think Africa Press. James, what are we going to talk about today?
We're going to look ahead to Mali's presidential election. It's World Indigenous Peoples Day, and Uganda effectively bans political protest.
And the Kurdish National Conference in the Iraqi city of Erbil is only days away. We ask why Turkey's legislators haven't addressed the issue of Kurdish rights yet.
Also ahead, we'll find out whether Israelis think a new law proposal to ban foie gras is kosher.
The current move on behalf of the Israeli government is a smart one. I think it's a rare instance in which we are actually fulfilling our self-proclaimed goal of being a beacon onto the nations.
Plus, we'll head to the small Italian village of Pordenone, where the first long-lost film of Orson Welles has just been discovered.
It is an extraordinary find because this film sheds light on a crucial phase in Orson Welles' career. In a way, this film is a sort of bridge between his theatrical career and his cinematic career.
All that, plus we'll also leave through this morning's Nordic front pages and we'll also play some music as well. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, let's catch up with the latest world news headlines with David Spencer.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. The United States has ordered all non-essential staff to leave its consulate in the northeastern Pakistan city of Lahore. The State Department says it is due to a credible threat. Washington has also warned US citizens not to travel to Pakistan. The warning in Lahore comes 2 days after Washington evacuated some diplomats from Yemen, where officials say 14 suspected militants have been killed in US drone strikes. At least 8 people have been killed after gunmen opened fire outside a mosque on the outskirts of the southwestern Pakistan city of Quetta. About 15 others were wounded in the attack, which came as worshippers left the Sunni Muslim mosque after early prayers. On Thursday, dozens of people died in a suicide bomb blast in Quetta. Protesters have taken to the streets in India to demand a tougher response from the government to the killing of 5 Indian soldiers in Kashmir. For the first time on Thursday, India directly accused the Pakistan army of involvement in the ambush, which took place on Tuesday. India's main opposition party has accused the government of trying to play down the attack and of being too soft on Pakistan. The president of the Darjeeling District Committee of the BJP, Nipan Das, says the government's response has been gutless.
This Congress government is not only corrupt and dishonest, but they are absolutely powerless. They don't have any power, they don't have any guts, they don't have any spirit. They don't care for the Indian army, they don't care for the citizens of India. The Pakistani intrusion is going on one after another. They're killing our innocent army people, but the Indian government is absolutely keeping quiet.
Zimbabwe's opposition MDC party is expected to launch a legal challenge today against last week's presidential election result, claiming that the vote was rigged. President Robert Mugabe claimed victory with 61% of the vote, but rival Morgan Tsvangirai alleges massive fraud. The Zimbabwe Electoral Commission says more than 300,000 voters were turned away, with the number of rejected voters one of the key concerns of the opposition. Around 1,500 people have had to leave their homes as wildfires rage across parts of Southern California. The fire started near the city of Banning earlier this week and has now covered around 10,000 acres of land. 1,000 firefighters, 13 helicopters and 6 air tankers are helping to tackle the flames. This fire captain says conditions aren't helping them.
Wind is a definite factor in this, and the fuels themselves are helping with this, as dry as they are in the season. Depending on what the wind does, it could actually change direction as the cooling starts and starts moving the opposite direction. And as we move to that, we definitely will have a different firefight on our hands.
Researchers say there have been positive results from an experimental malaria vaccine in clinical trials. The team of scientists in the United States said the test results were the most promising yet of any experimental vaccine, but resisted calling the trial a breakthrough as only a small number of people were involved. Malaria, commonly spread by mosquitoes, infected 219 million people in 2010 and killed an estimated 660,000, according to estimates by the World Health Organization. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, David Spencer. It's now just coming up to 6 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Op London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London,
desde Londres.
Holanda.
London, London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London. The time is 17.06 in Sydney. It's 14.06 in Jakarta and 8.06 here in London. It's time now to set the day's news agenda with the three big stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Today we're joined by James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press. James, happy Friday and welcome to the
Thank
program.
Thank you very much.
Of course, this weekend, people in Mali will be heading back to the polls. What can you tell us?
Yes, on Sunday, Malians get their second chance in 2 weeks to vote for their president. It's the second round of the vote. And the guy who came first, Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, known as IBK popularly, is pretty much dead cert to win. He got about 40% in the first round. Cisse, who he's up against, got just under 20. And 20 of the other 25 candidates, excluding him and Cisse, have backed him. So it's the kind of last couple of days before the vote. Campaigning has drawn down, and now it's sort of looking ahead to what he's going to be like as a president.
Now, you mentioned it's 2 weeks since the initial vote, and the turnout then was considered quite high, although it wouldn't be in many countries, around 50%.
Yeah.
Are people going to be able to muster the enthusiasm to get to the polls again, especially when they're just recovering from Ramadan?
I think that it's likely that there'll be less. So then they had to scale it down a bit, and it's just fallen under the magic 50% number, which still isn't very good. But in context, it's good. It's never been above 40 in a Malian election beforehand.
But why is it so low?
Well, in specifically with this election, there are lots of people who have been unable to vote because they haven't been able to get their voter cards and so on. And there are lots of refugees who've had, or internally displaced people who've had their voter cards sent to their home address rather than where they are. But in general, Malian politics tends to be a choice between the same figures within the political class, within the same elite, which functions along the same kind of patronage networks.
So a bit like Western countries then?
So yeah, quite a lot like Western countries, and there's not an enormous amount of difference. I mean, to illustrate the point, IBK, who's the front runner, has presented himself as the candidate against the political class. So this is a guy who was prime minister for pretty much all of the 90s, who is, you know, was friends with the last president, who's very close with the other candidates, having, you know, often served with them in administrations. But he has managed to present himself as not the just I'm the same kind of technocratic guy, but I'm going to restore dignity. And he's had to do that to win the election. And so basically unpopularity of the political class and the very shallow nature of Mali's democratic systems means that there's never been that much engagement.
Well, that's what IBK is saying he's going to do when he wins. But when he actually does win, and by all accounts, as you say, it looks certain that he will, what kind of president will he be?
Well, judging from how he was in the 90s, he was pretty firm with anybody who opposed. He wasn't very nice to trade unions. He wasn't very nice to students. He wasn't very nice to protesters. He's talking a lot, though, about returning Mali's dignity. So I think there's going to be a lot of sort of nationalist statements, a lot of trying to return pride and a lot of trying to heal in that way rather than... He doesn't have a particularly exciting and different from other candidates policy platform. It's actually Cisse, the other candidate, who's really stressing his technocratic credentials, how he's going to build more schools and this sort of thing. Also, IBK was more friendly than pretty much all other major political figures in Mali with the coup leaders. And so his relationship with the military and also with the people who supported the military is much better. So he's perhaps in the best position to be a consensual figure, but and his nature is to be pragmatic, but he is pretty firm if people get run across him.
It all seems a bit tough on Soumaïla Cissé, who by all accounts was a finance minister with a deal of integrity, which has got to be fairly unusual.
That is in a country where pretty much everyone is accused of corruption on a very large scale, even the last president accused of being involved in narco trafficking. Yes, that is a bit strange. But Cissé has failed to kind of capture massive imagination because he has run his campaign very much as, you know, I'm a can-do technocrat candidate. And Mali is calling out for...
Somebody who's nasty.
Not necessarily somebody who's nasty, but somebody who they feel that the last process is over. The last 18 months, last 2 years, which have been so terrible, that's over. Now we've got a return to some sort of status quo. And maybe a Cissé-like candidate, although because of age, it may not be him next time.
And all the while, the UN peacekeeping force is still in the country.
Yep.
It'll be interesting to see what happens next, because obviously IBK is saying he wants to restore the honour of Mali.
Yep.
What role will the UN play in that restoring of honour?
Well, so he's slightly hamstrung with respect to relationship with the Tuaregs, because the international community, France and the UN, are going to still have a very powerful role to play. I mean, in fact, the whole timing of this election is caused by outside forces. So his ability to really set the entire agenda and the entire agenda of the South, where he's much more popular, he got about 70% of the vote in the capital, Bamako, is slightly hamstrung by that.
Now, it is Indigenous Peoples Day today.
Yes.
And I understand that a good point in case in point to highlight this is the case of the Bushmen of the Central Kalahari Game Reserve.
Absolutely. So this is in Botswana. The Bushmen are an Indigenous people in southern Africa. There are about 100,000 of them, and they're the original inhabitants of southern Africa. And in Botswana, they've been given this area right in the middle of the country, which is their ancestral land to live on and practice their way of life. And about 10 years ago, there were diamonds discovered there, and they basically got forced out. And in 2006, they won a court case saying that, no, actually, that's their ancestral land and they can return. They won a high court case in Botswana. But then since then, only some of those listed in the court case have been able to return. Others have only been allowed to apply for a permit to go there for 1 month. And basically, they have continued to be evicted from their homeland. So the new case that they've rebrought started last month. But their lawyer, who's British, who represented them in the last case, Gordon Bennett, he has been banned from the country. He's not been allowed in.
And James, finally, let's move on to another story in Africa. This time, it's about Uganda. Remember when President Museveni, when he first came to power, many people in the West lauded him as this great example of democracy and how a leader on the African continent should be. Things have drastically changed, though, since he's been in power.
He's far too clever for that. he uses anything and everything available to him to place himself in the best possible position, and now he's playing around with how he manages popular dissent. So there's been a bill that he got passed through Parliament by his party's lawmakers, who dominate Parliament, which effectively bans political protest. You're allowed to do things through formal channels. Political parties are allowed to have rallies and so on, but protest of three or more people that has to be registered with the police, and they can say no for pretty much any reason. And this, but he hasn't signed it yet, but I think he's going to sign it, but then he's going to use it in the kind of in his traditional manner, where he allows some people a bit of slack and then he clamps down on others to make sure nobody feels completely at ease.
How's this different from the situation we have in London, where you can't protest in front of the Houses of Parliament anymore?
if we had one more person, this would be not allowed. If there were four of us and we're talking about politics, we should have got a permit a week ago. It's significantly worse than the smaller prevention of freedom of association and freedom of speech in Britain or America or Western Europe.
James, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. That is all the time we have for today. But many thanks for coming on to the program and helping us to set the day's agenda.
Thanks for having me.
James Schneider, the editor of Think Africa Press. Many thanks.
Coming up, we ask why Turkish ministers are on holiday while the Kurdish National Assembly meets.
The menu brings you the culinary stories and tales that are sure to inspire. From cake, steak and tapas to oysters, chicken and caviar, the menu roams the world in search of the best things to eat and the best places to eat them in. We uncover the trends that are taking hold and interview those spearheading a gastronomic movement.
The spirit in there represents the legacy of everything where we have been involved in the rum-making business. You have to taste it to believe it.
Okay, can we take Peruvian food back to London? A different type of corns, you know, a different type of cheese. And I knew at that stage, yeah, this is good.
So if you don't know the difference between a Salzburger Knockel and Kolonskink, a head cheese and a Faluda, tune into the menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours London time. I hope you're hungry.
That's The Menu, in association with Krug.
Ever thought of shaking off those golden handcuffs? Or had a daydream about going solo, striking out, far from the gentle plod of your day job? Then it's time you tuned in to The Entrepreneurs. Every week, we meet the brave, intrepid, sometimes bodacious businessmen and women who have done just that.
What we're trying to do is not create a fragrance, but rather evoke something through scents.
It's a show that allows you to learn business nous by example. So, if you want to learn how to open a thriving organic bakery, patent a savvy invention, set up an artisanal microbrewery, or export a finely crafted product to the world, The Entrepreneurs is a living, working audio Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
Welcome back to Midori House here in London on Monocle 24. Now, it's been a crisis that's been bubbling away for more than 28 years between the Turkish government in Ankara and the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK. That party is led from jail currently by Abdullah Öcalan, and it's been fighting hard for an independent Kurdistan. The conflict between the two sides has claimed more than 45,000 lives, and estimates say it's cost the Turkish economy nearly half a trillion dollars, mind-boggling figures. But the near three-decade struggle seems to have had a glimmer of hope earlier this year.
Prime Minister Erdogan's government and the PKK party agreed to a ceasefire at the start of this year. Öcalan's fighters have been told to disarm, and many have even left the country for bases in northern Iraq. So with all signs pointing in the right direction, some are beginning to raise doubts, however, about Erdogan's true intentions. In the next few days, the Kurdish National Congress will meet with representatives from Iraq, Turkey, Iran, and Syria. But questions are being raised about why more hasn't been done for Kurdish rights in Turkey. Well, joining us now on the line is Fawaz Jerjes, director of the Middle East Center at the London School of Economics and Political Science. Fawaz, welcome to the program. We've got this big congress happening between these four countries. Do we know what's going to be top of the agenda?
Well, I mean, the basic topic is the peace process. The basic topic is to find ways and means to resolve the, as you said, the almost three decades conflict. And I think in this particular sense, one of the most important elements that Prime Minister Erdogan yesterday talked about is that the Turkish parliament will pass a package. It's called the democratization package, that basically would represent a second step in the peace process between the Turkish government and the Kurdish community. And I think everyone, thinks that this is a very special moment, both for the Kurds and Turkey, because the Kurds will be at least allowed to exercise their cultural rights, their educational rights, and more local government and political economy.
Now, this all does indeed sound like a great big step forward. And yet, as we highlighted earlier on, the parliament in Turkey is on holiday at this momentous time. Is this a case of mixed signals?
Yes and no. I mean, I think the Erdogan government realizes the importance of passing the so-called the democratization package. And that's why the Turkish parliament will reconvene even during the summer break in order to pass this particular package. And I think the reason why I'm a bit hopeful, because the prime minister, the Turkish prime minister Erdogan, finds himself in a very difficult situation. He faces a great deal of social protest at home. He realizes that if the package, if the Kurds are not really fully integrated into the political and cultural rights in the country, that the peace process basically will face a major setback. I think it's in his own interest and his party to pass this particular package of legislation that addresses the legitimate rights of the Kurdish people. So even though there are many skeptics, the next few days and next few weeks will show the commitment of the Erdogan government to really accord rights to the minority Kurds in Turkey, who represent 20% of the 75 million people. It's a sizable community, and I think let's keep in mind that the Kurdish community have really given up on their more ambitious, you might say, aspirations of having an autonomous state. All they really ask for now is basically educational rights, cultural rights, language, local governance, and also the ability to have to govern themselves in their northeastern part of Turkey.
And Fawaz, it's interesting there you mentioned the social protest in the country. Obviously, it's been over 2 months now since those protests about Gezi Park have really spiraled and really been a real challenge for the Erdogan government. How much do you think that has played with Erdogan really pushing through these new reforms? Has there been a fear that the PKK is finding some kind of connection with the protesters on the streets?
Well, that's exactly what the Prime Minister Erdogan has asserted. The Prime Minister has tried to portray the social protests as an extension of a violent actions inside Turkey. He has insinuated that the PKK was an integral part of the social protest against his own government. I think the situation, as you all know, is much more complex. There's a great deal of restiveness inside Turkey. There's a great deal of anger at basically the reduction of the democratic space in Turkey, the conservative posture of the Erdogan government. So in this particular sense, regardless of what the prime minister says, I think he finds it in his own interest, in his party's interest, to begin the process of to really reduce the damage that has taken place to his own image inside Turkey and outside Turkey, also by trying to meet major demands of the peace process. The peace process basically requires the Erdogan government to take into account the aspiration, the cultural, educational, and local governance aspiration of the Kurdish people. So this is the second step after the ceasefire, which basically has been observed by the PKK.
Thank you very much indeed, Fawaz. That was Fawaz Yezhez, the director of the Middle East Centre at the London School of Economics.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monaco 24. Hong Kong,
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
This is Monaco 24.
Now, it is a delicious delicacy or a culinary abomination. The debate about pâté de foie gras has been raging for decades. For many gourmands, it's the ultimate in indulgence, but others feel rather queasy, not just about eating what's actually enlarged goose liver, yum yum, but more importantly, the pain inflicted on the animal to produce foie gras. Well, Western governments have debated for years whether or not to outlaw it.
And another country has now entered the debate, and this is likely to raise eyebrows. Israel is mulling over whether it should pull foie gras from its shelves. You have to bear in mind that Jewish people and goose liver go back a long way, but apparently many Israelis would be happy to accept a proposed ban on the sale of foie gras, as Monocle's Joseph Dana reports from Tel Aviv.
If we are to believe culinary legends,
then history would have it that the Jewish people learned the method of enlarging goose liver to make foie gras during the Roman colonization of Palestine. As Jews spread throughout Europe, they carried this practice with them. Enlarged goose liver provided them with an excellent cooking medium, in line with strict religious dietary laws, known as kashrut. Historic legends tend to be foggy, but one fact is unavoidable. Back in the day, European Jewry had a deep love affair with goose liver. But times have changed. Today, a movement is attempting to ban the sale of foie gras in Israel.
It was a statement to say that, you know, we might disagree about many things, but we agree that we want no part at all in this kind of delicacy, which is done at the expense, at the pain of an animal which can't protect itself.
That is Yesh Atid Parliament member Dov Lipman. His proposed bill banning the consumption of foie gras in Israel recently passed its first reading in the Israeli Knesset.
I think it's an important statement that Israel will hopefully make in terms of our humanity and decency and morality. I think that's a very important victory for Israel, assuming that it passes.
In 2003, the Israeli Supreme Court ordered the Ministry of Agriculture to ban the force feeding of geese on Israeli soil. Despite a handful of appeals, the law has been in effect since 2006. The new legislation, which would entirely ban the sale of foie gras, addresses one of the main consequences of the 2003 Israeli Supreme Court decision, namely, the relocation of Israeli goose farms to other countries. Ruthie Russo is a food journalist at the Israeli daily Ma'ariv, who has been closely following the foie gras controversy. An avid bird watcher, she explains how Israeli goose farmers have avoided the laws banning production of enlarged goose livers.
It turns out that the biggest farmer during those days, he killed all the geese he had. Mm-hmm. He took all the rabbis that worked for him. He bought a huge farm in Hungary, and he made it kosher with the rabbis he had, who he sent there. And now we just export all the foie gras and the geese from Hungary. You can't export geese or foie gras from anywhere else in the world because it has to be kosher. You're not allowed to import non-kosher food to Israel. And this is the only kosher geese farm in the world. It's owned by an Israeli who had the geese farm here in Israel.
Goose liver is a popular dish here in Israel. Usually the Israeli version of foie gras, which is not of the same quality as in France, is served in kebabs or grilled. Ruthie Russo tells me that while sales dipped in 2003, the delicacy can now be found easily in Israel.
You know, it wasn't popular for a few years, but I think it's gaining back its popularity. I think because when it was part of the discourse, then people felt worse to eat foie gras. And, you know, after they did the law, so the law was enacted, so people felt that now it's fine, you know. Now it's clean and we don't force feed our animals, so we just eat foie gras that someone else force fed.
Despite its relative popularity, many Israelis feel as though progressive legislation banning the production and sale of the food confirms, perhaps ironically, a foundation principle of the state. Yuval Ben-Ami is an Israeli cultural critic and writer based in Tel Aviv.
First of all, I don't want to come off as a hypocrite. I am a meat eater. I'm a Francophile. I love foie gras. At the same time, I am appalled by the treatment of animals, and I think that the current move on behalf of the Israeli government is a smart one, a humane one. Not only does it concern the way we eat, but I think it's a rare instance in which we are actually fulfilling our self-proclaimed goal of being a beacon onto the nations. We are creating a move here that can be later replicated into other spheres of trade and industry, which is ethically dubious.
Given the historic Jewish relationship with foie gras and the sheer numbers of problems facing Israeli society today, it seems strange that the country would be engaged in such a vociferous debate about its banishment. But popular support for anti-foie gras legislation points to the fact that, while Israelis might have a taste for foie gras, they want to be seen internationally as pushing progressive policies in at least one realm of civic life. For Monocle, in Tel Aviv, I'm Joseph Dana.
And in the next half hour of the program, we'll discover Orson Welles' first professional film, which has been found and restored in the small Italian city of Pordenone.
It is an extraordinary find because this film sheds light on a crucial phase in Orson Welles' career. In a way, this film is a sort of bridge between his theatrical career and his cinematic career.
So lots to look forward to in the next half hour of this program, but it is exactly 8:30 here in London, which means it's time for the news headlines. Here's David Spencer.
Thank you. The United States says a credible threat has led to them withdrawing all non-essential staff from the northeastern Pakistan city of Lahore. The State Department has also warned US citizens not to travel to Pakistan. Meanwhile, at least 8 people have been killed after gunmen opened fire outside a mosque on the outskirts of the southwestern Pakistan city of Quetta. About 15 others were wounded in the attack, which came as worshippers left the Sunni Muslim mosque after early prayers. US and Russian officials are due to meet in Washington, despite the political mood between the two countries hitting one of its lowest points since the end of the Cold War. This week, President Barack Obama cancelled a summit in Moscow with President Vladimir Putin after Russia gave asylum to former US spy agency contractor Edward Snowden. A legal challenge is expected to be formally lodged in Zimbabwe today, disputing last week's presidential election result. Robert Mugabe claimed victory with 61% of the vote, but rival Morgan Tsvangirai's MDC party alleges massive fraud. A nuclear power plant in Taiwan may have been leaking radioactive water for 3 years, according to a report by the government's watchdog. It says the plant has been leaking toxic water from storage pools of 2 reactors. The site is in a remote northern coastal location, but not far from densely populated Taipei. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, David. David, we'll be back at the top of the hour with another check of the world news headlines. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Guy Deloney.
How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? This is Orson Welles. I'm speaking for the Mercury Theater, and what follows is supposed to advertise our first motion picture. Citizen Kane is the title, and we hope it can correctly be called a coming attraction.
I think he might be underselling it, don't you reckon, Phil?
Just slightly.
You're probably familiar with Orson Welles' iconic first feature film. Citizen Kane is rated by many the greatest movie ever made, though not, incidentally, by users of the Internet Movie Database, IMDb. Where do you think they rank Citizen Kane, Phil?
Well, I would think maybe top 5.
Not even, just about top 50, number 45 to be precise. And in reverse order, just give you a few samples of the top 10. Fight Club is at number 10. One of the all-time greatest films.
Of all time.
Yes, the Brad Pitt...
About soap, isn't it?
Soap epic, yeah. Yes, that's right. The Dark Knight at number 6.
I'm going to be honest, I did enjoy that film.
Did you enjoy it the sixth most of any film you've ever seen?
I don't know. I got to be honest, and I don't know. I can't say.
And at number one, the greatest film ever made, according to users of Internet Movie Database, is?
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
That's in the top 10.
Is it?
The top 20, I think. Okay. It's somewhere in there, anyway. It's The Shawshank Redemption.
Interesting.
Okay. That's interesting in italics, interesting. I believe.
Do you agree with that?
Not at all, no.
Well, I just had a look on the, Empire magazine, which of course is all about cinema. Guess what they had as the number one greatest film of all time?
Of all time.
I think it's a good choice.
Is it American?
Yes.
The Godfather.
Correct. I think that's a good choice,
also
right?
At number 2 in the IMDb list.
Yeah,
it's all good. Right. It's a bit obvious, though, isn't it? But there we have it. Anyway, back on topic.
Oof, tough crowd.
You may not have known that Citizen Kane, because we were talking about Orson Welles, wasn't actually Orson's first encounter with professional cinema. 3 years before his Hollywood debut, he'd produced a 40-minute silent film that was supposed to accompany Too Much Johnson, a farce he hoped to bring to Broadway with his Mercury Theatre.
But the show never quite made it, and the film mysteriously disappeared. Well, for years, Welles scholars fantasized about Too Much Johnson without ever seeing any part of it. Until now, that is. A 35mm nitrate print has been located in the small Italian village of Pordenone, home to the biggest silent cinema festival. Well, to find out more, Monocle's Daphne Denis spoke with Paolo Cerci, senior curator of motion pictures at the George Eastman House in Rochester, New York, which restored the footage.
It is an incredible story, beginning with the fact that the film has been found in the city of Pordenone in Italy, which is the home to the most important festival dedicated to silent cinema, the Pordenone Silent Film Festival. Turns out that a print of Orson Welles' lost film to Mack Johnson was abandoned in a warehouse in Pordenone for over 30 years. And, well, we just found out about it, and we were able to rescue the film and restore it. It is an extraordinary find also because this film sheds light on a crucial phase in Orson Welles' career. In a way, this film is a sort of bridge between his theatrical career and his cinematic career. It is thanks to Too Much Johnson that Orson Welles basically fell in love with cinema.
Can you tell us a bit more about the film? What can people expect? I know it's premiering in October.
The film is basically a slapstick comedy. It was meant to be a slapstick comedy in Max Sennett's style in three parts. Each part was meant to be a prologue to an act of stage play by William Gillette called Too Much Johnson. Orson Welles was never able to finish the film. So what we have found is the work print that Orson Welles had edited until a few days before the premiere of the stage play. So from a narrative standpoint, there isn't much you can expect because the film has not been fully edited. You will find several shots that are repeated. But what's great about the film is that visually it is very, very much an Orson Welles film. The sense of composition, the beauty of the images, and some sequences that really remind us of the best parts of Citizen Kane and the Magnificent Ambersons.
What kind of scenes? Can you give us a little bit more?
There is one scene in particular. There is a chase happening in the streets of Manhattan. The scene is seen from above, and there are hundreds of containers, boxes, cans, all piled up. It's a gigantic mess. Lots of cans and containers. When I first saw the scene, it immediately reminded me of the final sequence of Citizen Kane, the warehouse of Citizen Kane, where the Rosebud sled is being found.
No, I guess Rosebud is just a piece in a jigsaw puzzle. Missing piece.
And going back to the way that Orson Welles lost this movie, how did it happen? I know that it was there once and then he didn't know what happened to it.
Yeah, this is one of the big mysteries about the film. Orson Welles had repeatedly said that he had the film in his house in the outskirts of Madrid. He had even shown the work print to some friends. He was even thinking about re-editing the film and giving it as a gift to his friend Joseph Cotten, who is one of the protagonists of the film. And then there was this fire in 1970. So supposedly the film was destroyed in 1970. But, well, it wasn't, because it was found in Pordenone. Why in Pordenone? We do not know. On the other hand, we all know that Orson Welles was living a rather nomadic life in the late years of his career. He was moving from one country to another, trying to find money to make movies. But still, the mystery remains such for the time being. So we're taking the good news for what they are, having found this really important film in Welles' career.
What's the reaction there? How many people are traveling to or calling you or contacting you about this film?
Well, look, since we have given the announcement, I have spent my time answering phone calls and email messages. My field is, I'm receiving questions almost every minute. I barely have time to sleep a few hours and grab something to eat because no one could possibly expect this kind of discovery. So we expect quite a bit of a crowd at the world premiere in Pordenone on October 9 and in Rochester, New York on October 16 for the US premiere.
And that was Dr. Paolo Cerci, the senior curator of motion pictures at the George Eastman House in Rochester, New York, speaking to Monocle's Daphne Denis from the small village of Pordenone. And the film will premiere there at La Giornata del Cinema Muto on October the 9th.
You're listening to Midori House. Up next, we'll be getting a taste of one of New York's delicious cronuts.
The Review is Monocle 24's weekly review and preview of the arts. Every Saturday, we take a relaxed look back at the books, TV shows, films, music, theatre, and events that have made our week, while looking around the corner to scout out the next big thing.
It doesn't feel sappy, it doesn't feel sentimental. It does have a certain heft.
It's very Darwinian. The shows that do well run and the ones that don't close. And there have been some quite high-profile flops and some great successes as well.
For me, it's riotous, it's tasteless, but it's actually dynamic as well. It has momentum.
Join Monocle's editors as they sit down with our favourite critics, opinion makers and key industry figures for some in-depth discussion and lively debate. And we provide inspiration for the weekend from cities around the world.
It's a real divider because I know some people just love this film and other people really just hate it.
That's a review every Saturday at midday London time and across the weekend, right here on Monocle 24.
Each Sunday on Monocle 24, we like to take stock.
The wonder of history for the journalist is you can delve into this immense booty of information.
You don't write a book lightly, and I didn't really want to write a book, so I had to find something which could only be explained in a book.
Take the global pulse.
Singapore is too small to have a known huge art scene to be competitive on a global level.
The old distinction between policy being made in London and executed by diplomats abroad has gone.
A lot of people come south for the opium harvest, and literally as soon as the last opium poppy is harvested, they will then take up arms and fight for a few weeks. It's purely practical.
And occasionally take things down a notch too.
I mean, if someone wants to buy it for $100 million, we would sell it.
Our radio station's got quite a wealthy demographic. I think you're in the right place.
To end the week with the best chat.
I've been confused for Kenny Loggins, actually.
I want to start with a very simple question. Why did we go to war with Iraq?
Some great music.
A grand piano is kind of a condescending icon at this point.
And some good fun to set up Sunday and warm the week ahead. The Monocle Weekly. Your week starts here.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Guy Delaney, where the time is 15:42 in Singapore, it's 10:42 in Istanbul, and 8:42 here in London. Now, nobody enjoys a good food craze like New Yorkers. The city knows no limits when it comes to creativity in food, and the latest obsession comes from a little bakery in Soho.
The Cronut was unveiled a few months ago. That's Cronut, Phil. It's a hybrid pastry created by the French chef Dominique Ancel, and it's become the undisputed protagonist of this hot New York summer. Sarah Schifano reports for this week's edition of The Menu.
Half American donut, half French croissant. Fried, glazed, filled with cream, and topped with an icing. Meet the Cronut, a pastry that is taken New York by its sweet tooth. In less than 2 months, this pastry has substituted the classic cupcake in the hearts of New Yorkers and become the talk of the town. In his little and very busy bakery, I met the man behind the magic, Dominique Ancel.
So the Cronut was a little bit of a challenge to myself and the team. I wanted to do a donut, but not a classical American donut. I wanted to come up with something new, something fresh and original. So I worked on the recipe for about 2 months. Did like 10 different batches in order to come up with the perfect texture. I wanted something that was similar to a croissant, but it is not a croissant. It's a different dough, but it's the same technique. Something that could fry easily without being too greasy. Something that could hold up the cream and stay nice and moist.
The recipe, of course, is top secret. Delivering the pastries, though, is not an easy process.
It takes about 3 days to prepare a batch of cronuts. The first day we make the dough and we let it rest. The second day we incorporate the butter and we fold the dough. And the third day we cut it, we fry it, we fill it and we glaze it. So it's a very labor intense and it's a long process. The kitchen is actually running 24 hours every day and we're trying to keep up with production and serve as many people as we can.
For Ancel, the cronut was just an addition to, apart from a couple of staples, an always-changing menu. What he wasn't expecting was the celebrity status he achieved in such a short time.
We launched the Cronut at the beginning of May, and it's been very, very popular, and it took off right away since day one. We had a mention on Grub Street about the Cronut. Grove Street called us and they told us to make more cornets because they had an increase of 300% on their website. They had over 140,000 hits on their website in about an hour. So that was something that grew up like very quickly and it became like viral and very popular in a few days.
As the cornet went viral, people started lining up from 4:30 a.m. to get one of the daily 300 pastries. Ads came up on Craigslist offering cornets for sex exchanges, and even the imitators and scalpers were lured out of the woodwork to pick up some of the crumbs.
I was waiting in line to buy cornets since about 5:40 this morning. I have an extra cornet because you can buy two, and I got one that I want, and I have an extra. And I know that there's about probably 250 people in line here who aren't going to get one. Someone would be wants to buy my extra cornet, I'd be happy to sell it to them.
And how much are you asking for a cornet?
Well, it depends. I would be happy with like $25, but realistically, if I start at $25, you're not going to get that much. So I'm hoping to get like $20-$25 for it. But we'll see. I've been asking like $40, and people seem to like be giving me looks of hatred. But right as I walked out, some lady has paid $100 for two of them. So I don't really know. So I would, if I get $25, I'd be super happy though.
When asked what he was going to do with the other cronut, it was hard to fault him for his romantic spirit.
I'm saving it for my girlfriend who I'm seeing tonight, who lives in Boston. So I'm giving it to her. I don't really care that much about pastries, to be totally honest. Trying to get something back for all of my time sitting here this morning at leave my house at 4:45.
If you thought this was cute or crazy, consider the countless other stories emerging around this very New York City mania.
We had so many like beautiful and touching stories at the bakery. There's this old man that came. He wrote us an email. He was 89 years old. He wanted to buy a cornet for his son's 60th birthday. And he came, we went in line, we got him water. He spent a few hours with his son. He got the cornet, they ate it together, and then he wrote us an email to say that it was the most amazing time he spent with his son since his son was 5 years old. And he was very happy like to have shared this time with him, and they had time to reconnect.
Believe it or not, the hardest part of this story was to find someone willing to share the cornet tasting with me. Finally, I found two Australian girls who arrived at 6:30 and waited in line for 3 hours.
To be honest, I thought it would be more flaky in texture, but it was just a little bit chewy for my liking, and it tasted like an oily churro. I think it's more donut than croissant, and it was pretty oily, so I probably wouldn't line up again for it.
I'm still finishing it. I thought it was delicious. Also like a churro, but filled with like a blueberry jelly and cream. It's a bit sweet for first thing in the morning, but I'd definitely try it again.
Will the cornet become a New York classic? Only time will tell. In the meantime, Ansel is already looking toward the future and has launched a new hybrid, the frozen s'more. Half marshmallow, half ice cream. It looks delicious, of course, and I guess I'll try it before it goes viral. For Monocle, in New York, I'm Sara Schifano.
Street food going viral.
It's odd.
It's not what
I've never
want.
Had a cronut, though.
I don't think I want one by the sounds of that, to be honest with you. Am I being unfair to it?
No, I don't think so. Our next guest, maybe I wonder if our next guest has had a cronut. Not the singer, our newspaper reviewer, Marcus.
He's looking nonplussed on the other side of the glass. I think we better move swiftly on. We're about to flick through the finished front pages, as you notice, so here on Midori House on Monocle 24. But before that, to get in a Scandinavian mood, this is En Halu Kuala Taniona by Jenny Vartiainen. Was En Halu Kuala Taniona by Jenny Vartiainen, who's now my second favourite Finnish artist, following the Seoul Investigators. So there we are. You're listening to Midori House with me, Guy Delaunay, and Phil Hahn. Time now to flick through the Finnish front pages, appropriately enough, with our very own Finnish presenter, Markus Hippi. Morning,
hello.
Markus.
Hello, good morning. How are you doing, Phil and Guy?
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday, happy Friday. I've been indeed going through the Nordic papers, Finnish papers mostly, and I have to say that it's a bit of a holiday season still there. There are two discussion topics that are dominating the news. The other one is about Obama and Russia relations and Snowden and all that. Well, Finland doesn't have too much to do about with that case. So therefore, all the papers are all about economy, Finnish economy. There's a Finnish economist very well known who just gave an interview to the biggest newspaper in Finland, Helsingin Sanomat, and he called Finland the Italy of the North.
And this that isn't a compliment.
No, it's not a compliment at all. It's actually quite a striking comparison. And I think it may be maybe a saying that may actually, you know, stay alive for years to come. Basically, the same thing has happened to Finland, what's been happening to Italy. Gradually, year by year, the financial economy numbers have been going worse, and there's not really that much light in the horizon. Helsingin Sanomat writes quite extensively about this topic today, and what they are also saying that there is also a very important difference between Italy and Finland, because if Italy gets its things sorted, there is so much potential in the country that Italy may easily be able to boost its economy so that it starts going up again, whereas Finland is struggling, considering that Finland has been relying on traditional industries for a long time, and service industries and so on, modern industries are not doing that well at the moment yet. So there's a lot of unemployment, and there are even more news coming from Nokia and forestry companies.
And there's an interesting debate happening in Finland between whether or not to have an economic stimulus package in the country to help spur growth. I think the prime minister is against any idea of having kind of an economic stimulus package in order to spur growth.
The government has been criticized very much for not doing enough in this financial situation, and actually the financial minister just came out a day or two ago, and she said that we are going to be facing cuts in Finland, that is finally going to happen, but she didn't specify what that is going to be. And one of the problems, one of the obvious things that could be done in Finland, something that's been discussed a lot, would be to raise the pension age, but at the same time her party did promise before the elections that that is something that absolutely is not going to happen, and that's also been criticised. That's actually going to be quite expensive for Finland.
Of course, a well-known slogan many years ago is what's good for General Motors is good for the United States. Did the same apply for Nokia in Finland?
Pretty much. Finland was very dependent on Nokia, and it's been a very, very shocking actually to see what's been happening in Finland when Nokia has been going so seriously downhill. Let's talk about something nice now. Guggenheim
has expressed... You're depressed, aren't you?
Slightly. Guggenheim has expressed its interest to launch a new Guggenheim Museum in Helsinki. This was something that was quite extensively discussed last year already. And Helsinki City Council actually said no to that offer because they were considering that it was too expensive. Mm. And secondly, there was a lot of artists and creative people in Finland who felt like they wouldn't get enough attention if that museum was to come to Finland. Well, Guggenheim strikes back. They hired a PR agency in Finland, and they have come back to Finland. The leaders of the organization visited Helsinki a couple of days ago, and they met very influential people over there, politicians and so on, and they actually have come up with some kind of a new offer now that is going to be cheaper for Helsinki. We don't know the details yet, but...
Do we know what a Finnish Guggenheim Museum would look like? What would be in it?
No, we don't know. And actually, it's also under discussion whether Finnish Guggenheim should concentrate on getting the same Guggenheim art that's circulating from one museum to another, or whether it should actually concentrate on Finnish design and Finnish architecture. That is still to be discussed.
I'm just curious about this, because I would have thought that on many occasions we think of the Guggenheim and Bilbao, of course, people would look to attract a Guggenheim rather than having Guggenheim foist itself upon an unwilling recipient.
Exactly. That was so surprising. When I heard the news that Guggenheim wants to come to Finland, I took it for granted that obviously that is going to happen, because that would probably boost the tourism numbers massively. But at the same time, Finland is a small country. There's a lot of competition on the money that goes into culture. So when you have a new international player over there, the old players are obviously afraid. They feel threatened.
And Marcus, shall we talk about everyone in... Finland's, well, maybe in Sweden, actually, excitement over Eurovision?
Well, I think it's a funny comparison. In Sweden, in Stockholm, there is an ABBA auction taking place this weekend, and there is an amazing hype around it. There are so many people who are so excited about it.
There was an ABBA museum that opened earlier
this
year as well.
Exactly. They're all about Eurovision. Whereas in Finland, Finland won the Eurovision once. It was about 2003. Lordi won with this hideous hard rock tune. And they are from Rovaniemi, Lapland. And Rovaniemi town was so excited that they decided to name a town square according to Lordi. So there's Lordi Square there. Unfortunately, all this excitement has kind of suffered during all the years, and nowadays there's discussion in Rovaniemi whether they should just get back the old name or come up with something new.
Good Lordi. Sorry. Good Lordi. Or maybe not.
Thanks very much, Marcus. Monocle's Marcus Hippie there for the Finnish edition of our newspaper review. Well, that unfortunately is all the time we have for today. Thanks to our producer, Daphne Denis, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Zoe Tennant, and our studio manager, of course, was Alex Funnel. Up next, after the news, is Section D with Alid John. I'll be back with Poppy Trowbridge from Midori House at the same time on Monday. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And me, Guy Delaunay, it's goodbye, and thanks for listening.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.